The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Markets are down for the fifth week. Oil takes a beating as we're entering into the last week of May 2019. And our guest today is John Markman from Markman Capital Insights. All this and much more on episode number 613 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello and a great day to you. This is Andrew Horowitz. I am the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, the founder of Horowitz & Company as well, and we're an investment advisory firm. We have several different strategies that we work with, and we come to each and every week trying to find some really good insights into markets, some education, and really get a real good insight into what's happening. Our guest today is going to hopefully provide that. I really enjoy my time speaking with John Markman. I've known him for the better part of, 12 years now or so, maybe a little bit longer. Well, happy Memorial Day also to you. This is the Memorial Day weekend where we're going to have a holiday shortened week. Markets are closed on Monday, and it gives you the opportunity to get into the start of summer, that mood that's going to overtake you, where we're going to start seeing up north a little bit warmer weather, down here a lot warmer weather down here in Florida. And of course, barbecue and boating and all sorts of family and friends and great things. And not to mention that the sun stays out a lot longer, which is really good because, I don't know about you, it's depressing when the sun's not out, when it sets at 5 o'clock, 5:30. It's crazy. So that's good. As I mentioned, we are going to be in observance of the Memorial Day holiday on Monday. So that means that we're not going to see anything happening here in the U.S., although overseas markets are still open. And we'll see how that does start the week. It is also the final week of May, and it's a time when we often see the horses start getting very excited about getting back to the barn. If you've been horseback riding, you know that that second half of the trip and maybe even the last quarter of the trip, all of a sudden the horses get a little bit of a, they get a little excited, get a little extra kick in their step. And they know they're getting towards the barn. They know they're getting you off their back. And they get to eat some hay and relax and rest. And, you know, they like that. Well, it's kind of the same thing that happens towards the end of the month, and in particular towards the end of the quarter, where we have that window dressing that goes on, trying to pick up stocks and get things in the portfolio just right so that when they're published, you have the correct amount of positions that are aligned with the portfolio's objectives that can be published and out there in the public. So oftentimes you see some interesting trading going on at the end of the month, and we'll probably see a little bit of window dressing, I would expect, maybe Tuesday and Wednesday, and then we get back to business as usual. But right now, what's interesting is that markets have been a little bit, squirrely. And I'm going to talk to you about some of the stats in a second. But first, let's start and talk about what's happening on the economic front. And last week, it was a light week overall, but we did see that durable goods came in, and they were a little bit lighter than expected. And they fell about 2.1%. A lot of that was from the transportation input. And possibly that has to do with Boeing. It has to do with some of the things that are going on with the 737 MAX and what's happening with their stop in production right now. And it is possible that we did see that, greater than expected downstroke when it came to the durable goods. I also think that there's a lot of excessive inventories that are now basically bulging factory warehouses, and orders are a little bit lighter. We see this in the factory numbers. We see this in the manufacturing numbers. So probably durable goods orders were also hit by that. Housing markets seem to stabilize a bit, and the Fed was out with their minutes last week, and it seems to me that what they're trying to do is to, I guess, temper the idea that there's going to be a rate cut. They talked about this, you know, transitory inflation numbers they're seeing, and they expect that inflation is going to come back. But inside their discussion, it did seem to me that there was this backdrop of, you know what, we don't want to get markets too excited about the potential for a rate cut, but that's, you know, that's not really where we're at. We believe that we should be somewhat neutral at this point and standing on the sidelines, looking at all the data that's coming in, but not being necessarily in the camp of a rate cut at this point. Of course, if things don't go well, if there's a necessity to do so, that could happen. But if we have a pendulum swinging and to the left is a rate cut and to the right is a rate hike, they want to sort of make everybody believe they're right in the center. And I think markets had an expectation somehow magically that with their pivot that they did in December and into January, that the Fed was actually going to cut rates. A lot of talk about this and some of the upside and expansion of PEs and buying of the markets and this recovery that we saw. It looks like there was a good amount of expectation that there could be some kind of cut and that would be good for stocks. But I don't think so. Taking a look at what's happening next week. Let me get out the official economic reports that are hitting. On Tuesday, we have consumer confidence coming out, as well as the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index report. And what's interesting is you look at the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index, which is there's a few of them, but this one's a 20-city reading of price increases of houses over a year from a year-to-year basis. Now, for a long time, we were running at about, I would say, 5% on average, and then started coming down a bit. Right now, expectations are for about a 2.9% increase year over year on housing prices, meaning that housing prices are not appreciating as fast as they were. They're still growing. And we see this in the numbers that we've seen on new and existing homes and pending home sales and housing starts. All of these have been pointing to a slowdown. We see the commentary from a variety of the builders. We see what's happening with construction and construction jobs. So I don't think this is unexpected, and I think it's frankly kind of normal and healthy. You know, how long can you have houses that are appreciating at 5% per year? Essentially, at that level, we have what? About 14 and a half years till the prices double. So a little bit of a slowdown in the appreciation of housing prices is probably not the worst thing that we could see in the economy. Consumer expectations or consumer confidence expected to drop a little bit from 138 down to about 128. And, you know, once again, this is still a pretty elevated number and better than we saw back in December. So that's good. What else do we have? Let's see. Wednesday's not much going on there. Thursday, we do have initial claims, advanced international trade goods looking for a drop about $70 billion, which, again, makes sense from what we're seeing. GDP, the second estimate, you know, we came in at 3.2% last quarter. A lot of that was inventory build. And it looks like this is going to be revised to about 3%. Pending home sales, crude inventories. And on Friday, we'll see personal income, personal spending. Core PCE prices expected to increase by about 0.2%, which would be about almost a 2% year over year, as well as the University of Michigan consumer sentiment, the final for May. Looking to be about 100. As I had mentioned, we're going to have to talk about what's going on with markets. I mean, right now we are seeing that there has been a bit of a swoon in May, and that is something that has been now 5 weeks in a row. We're seeing that there is a down tick in markets. The S&P 500, the Dow Jones are now down about 4% for the month. The NASDAQ 100 is down 6%. Small caps are down about 5%. Emerging markets are off 9% for the month of May so far. Looking at some individual stocks, Apple's down 10%. Facebook is off by 6%. And the hardest hit have been some of the companies with the most international exposure. You know, you look at this as pretty obvious if we're seeing that there has been a significant increase in the cost of trade brought to you by the current administration. And now that we increase from 10% to 25%, that's probably going to hurt some of these companies. And that's why you're seeing some of these areas, for example, like Caterpillar, down 12% for the month. Banks aren't doing much better either, as the yield curve is now starting to get towards that inverted point again. We have still some inversion on the short end, still not on the 210s, but we're starting to see that it's creeping closer and closer to a level that we have to be concerned about, like we were very worried about. And markets put the brakes on back in November, October, November, as they saw the yield curve was starting to get into that inverting level again. And that's not helping banks. You know, banks need a pretty good yield curve because that's how their margins are based, right, for the base banking business that they do. So when you look at what's happening right now in terms of the markets, I think there's a reasonable sell-off because expectations from the Fed have been tempered, which was something that was much different in January. The trade war, which was supposed to be resolved very quickly and get into a reasonable amount of time, has been extended and dragged on for some time, and that's going to be a problem. And then on top of that, we're seeing that there is a realization that, you know, well, maybe we've done a little bit too much on the top end here. And with the yields as they are, with the Fed, you know, backing off, with the trade wars, well, maybe stocks are a little bit higher than the level that they should be. Maybe we expanded those PEs a little bit too dramatically. What's interesting to note is that utilities have been doing really well. And this is an area that you'd expect in a time of risk off to do better. They're up 2% for the month. Healthcare is hanging in there. Staples are also holding. And those are also the ones that when you see a risk off environment, oftentimes these are the sectors that do well. So the question is, where do we go from here? I mean, what's next? I mean, how are markets going to, you know, how are we going to work with the rest of not only the month, but the rest of the summer when you get a lower volume usually? Traditionally, you have a little less volume and there's a little bit more opportunity for corrective action in markets. I think that one of the most vulnerable sector right now from a technical standpoint looks like it's probably technology. It's probably the NASDAQ related. It's probably the Qs. If you look at where we are on a support level on the Qs, if we don't hold the levels about right where we are now, close to the levels that we are now, I mean, there is a potential for a flush down another 5%. Now, that won't be the worst thing. We still have tech up, what, 16% for the year or so? So I mean, it's not going to be like, oh my gosh, we're going in reverse and we're going to have a massive, not only correction, but a 20% drop. I mean, you know, you would look to see a healthy correction throughout any given year of about 10% here or there. And I think we're kind of in the throes of it. There's a lot of cross currents right now that are going on that you have to wonder what would be that magic bullet that all of a sudden the coast is clear, the green light is on, and everybody says, you know what? Okay, we're going back to a hardcore risk on environment. I mean, you see crude dropping off a cliff last week, down 6.8%, the worst week of 2019 and you know, the worst time for, you know, some time. The market down 5 weeks in a row, the worst consecutive weekly declines in terms of time period, not in terms of actual, you know, the thrust of it in terms of how much was lost, but since 2011. So you find all these things and you start seeing that utilities are picking up, and it's very clear if you step back from the screen for a second, people, just take a couple of steps back. Let's not look at the 1 minute candles. Let's kind of, or the tick charts. Let's take a step backwards and look at the weekly. We still have a long-term uptrend that is clearly intact. Yes, in some areas, in the small cap areas and in some emerging markets, it may be the potential that we're starting to break some trend lines clearly, no question about that. But at the same time, you know, either we have a market that has been really ramped up very nicely, took a lot back from the drop that we saw in December. And if you look at what's happening from companies that are no longer providing guidance in certain areas and holding off on capital expenditures and have been a little bit more conservative in their outlook, you have to wonder what will be the next leg in the near term for getting markets, you know, moving significantly. Just not there. It's just not there. We're starting to see some of these IPOs that were ramped up dramatically start to fall, come back at or to their IPO levels or below. Last couple that came out, the Uber IPO, the Lyft IPO, clearly a signal that markets, while there are animal spirits that are circulating there, not as much as we saw. So maybe a little bit more conservative style right now. I talked about this at length with Frank Curzio. He's on his show this week. You can find, I tweeted it. I put it up on Facebook. I put it up a variety of places. Over at CurzioResearch.com, you can listen to that discussion as well. I think it was a really good one. We talked about his beliefs on where we are in terms of, is it a trade war or not? And he's still questioning whether we're in an actual trade war. And I'm emphatic about, yes, we are in a trade war. While the labels are not as important, the facts are there. Especially with the last go-round of the walking out, canceling the meeting, increasing the tariffs from 10 to 25%, and then threatening to put on another $300 billion of goods at risk of a 25% tariff. And finally, the cherry on the cake, cherry on the top, was the Huawei clampdown, the national security clampdown, and basically putting everybody on warning and notice that you work with Huawei, you're against the United States, and this is a national security issue that we're bringing up here. So a lot going on here. All I'm saying is, you know, it's not a time necessarily right now to be leveraged up. And in the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, we actually brought down our overall allocation a month and a half ago. Not because we were just, you know, reading the tea leaves or looking at any of this, but it's a long, short exposure strategy. And one of the things we do in the core area is we allow for quantitative analysis. We look at screens. We look at fundamentals inside those screens, some technicals inside those screens, but we allow for a process to go on that we're looking for certain characteristics of investments and stocks. And when they don't meet those characteristics and they don't pass through the screen, they're not included. No questions. And what we found was fewer and fewer stocks were able to meet those criteria. And therefore, our overall exposure to our core equities in that segment of the strategy has been reduced. And that has allowed us to do a lot better than markets right now in this downstroke. Now, of course, there's a double-edged sword there that if your market starts screaming higher, we're underexposed. But okay, you know, we'll adjust that if, in fact, the criteria is met moving forward. You can check out everything about the Managed Growth Strategy over on the DisciplinedInvestor.com if you're interested and you're thinking, you know, maybe it's time to think about a little bit more of a different strategy, maybe even a diversification away from the usual, which is, you know, a long-only strategy. This is a long-short strategy. There's plenty of information, a quick video that can take you through some of the ways that we actually build the strategy, $50,000 minimum. And I hope to, you know, have you participate. It's a very cool program and something that I think would really, you really find to be different than what you've seen otherwise in terms of how we build this, et cetera. And it's, again, a great diversifier, in my opinion, for portfolios, because what it does is it gives you a much different strategy than just long only. Final thing I'll mention here is on Fridays through Trigger Charts, we have a Friday pre-market rundown. It's a live webinar. It's over, information on that is over on triggercharts.com. I've also tweeted it. Andrew Horowitz is the Twitter. You can find out more information about that. 9 a.m. replays will be available, but try to be there because we hit your stocks as well. Talk about, you know, what are the setups? What are the support resistance lines? We use volume at price and market profile. Some really, really cool tools that you'll see through the TradeStation platform. But Friday market rundowns, every Friday at 9 a.m., something new what we're doing. Come and check it out. Register. Registration is free, but you have to register or else you're not going to find out about it. On the show notes for episode number 613, there'll be a link to register and a quick video overviewing things. I hope to see you there. With that in mind, let's get to our guest and see what he has to say right now. And our guest today is John Markman. He's not been with us for some time, and I'm very happy to have him back. He writes some incredible newsletters covering the areas of futures and options, as well as a daily review through his Strategic Advantage. Writes for companies like Forbes and TheStreet.com. Has some great books out if you haven't had the opportunity to read that. So we're gonna pick his brain a little bit all the way from the West Coast. It's John Markman. Hey, buddy, how are you?
Great to be with you again. It's been a while.
So let's talk about a variety of things. I have a smattering of ideas that I put down that I want to talk to you about. And in no particular order, I thought we would start with a piece that you wrote, I think, just a couple of days ago in your Strategic Advantage, which I read regularly.
Thank you.
And it's about tariffs. And you quoted a source that looked at how much tariffs could actually impact GDP if, in fact, the tariffs on China went up to 25%, right? So this whole idea that the cost factors associated with this could really take create a hit to GDP. So do you believe this is actually something that's happened? First of all, do you believe the tariffs are destructive from an economic standpoint?
Well, they're a tax. So taxes always impede growth. I mean, when you take money away from people, whether it's businesses or individuals, they don't have access to it to do productive things. So it's definitely a detriment to the economy. I think the thing that people have to realize is that what's really important is not necessarily the size of the tariffs, but how long they last. If they last just
there's a lot I could say about that right there, but I'll skip that. Okay.
Go ahead. Just jump in.
Oh, about the size and how long it lasts. That's all I'm saying.
That's all you're saying. I gotcha. All right. Now this is turning into an episode of True TV.
Yeah.
Basically, it's how long the impact lasts. If it lasts for a few weeks and then they get an agreement, GDP growth will not be impacted. But if it lasts for months and months, you're going to see not only a erosion of GDP growth in the United States because of the decline in buying power, you're also going to see an increase in inflation. I think that it's really important for the White House and China to agree on this rather quickly. And I'm saying like in the next month or two, because after that, we start to see really long-term impacts both to inflation and the economy.
How come the 10% tariff that's been put on about $200 billion, before it was up to 25%, hasn't really shown up in the inflation numbers? I mean, if we didn't have that, would we have a terribly deflationary economy environment right now?
Well, I mean, we've only had them for a short period of time, the higher tariffs for a short period of time. So it takes a while for it to filter through the economy. You'll definitely see it, though, in coming months.
So one of the things that you...
If the tariffs continue and escalate.
So one of the things that you cited in this paper was that the damage from an escalation at this point, or the continuation, I should say, even so, from these tariffs can be upwards of about 0.7% of GDP moving forward. I mean, that's a significant bite, right?
Right. I mean, it's kind of comparable to the whole Brexit situation. If, there's a deal Brexit impact on the UK and the Europe, and there's a no deal impact. And what we're certainly looking at in terms of tariffs is that if there's no deal with the Chinese, then you're looking at an upward escalation that would really erode GDP by as much as, I would say, almost 1%, 1 percentage point, which is a lot. But if there is a deal, then, you know, we can forget about the concerns. Whatever tariffs there have been already will sort of filter through the economy without us really noticing them.
So what companies are you most concerned about with this whole, you know, trade war issue and this whole tariff? I mean, is there a specific sector or a specific company?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's more than tariffs, right? The White House has escalated this so-called war with China to individual companies, to barring certain companies from actually doing any business in the United States. So talking about companies like Huawei, which is a big, really big mobile networking and computer company in China. They buy a lot of merchandise from companies like Qualcomm, NVIDIA, et cetera. So, Xilinx. And so To the extent that they are going to be banned from buying from U.S. companies, you know, this is we're talking about a major impact to the tech space, as well as I think an increase in uncertainty mm-hmm. about what the next step might be. You know, when Wall Street can adjust to anything, if you tell me that Xilinx is going to have 25% less business than previously under Huawei, you know, we can discount that and get it, you know, Xilinx is going to take a hit to its valuation, but it's not going to take a hit forever. You know, it'll be discounted. But the White House keeps coming up with new ways of escalating its war with China. So there's a new sort of uncertainty principle, uncertainty level that's crept into the market that's going to erode on valuations in their own way.
So, yeah, and the one thing about Huawei was that they were the number one contender in creating and expanding the 5G network, right?
Yes, they're important. They're very, very important for expanding for the creation and expansion of 5G, primarily in Europe, but also in the United States. So, you know, the White House has said that it's concerned that Huawei will spy on U.S. and European users of its equipment. There's really never been any evidence of this. It really seems to be more like a talking point than anything else.
Yeah, because now we're starting to hear that drones can actually spy on us and send back information. And this whole Huawei thing has really gotten pretty out of control. I mean, we had this on a couple of companies in the past, but when it comes to this, who's going to replace? I mean, if we're going to go into the 5G space and we're going to have this extreme speed and we're going to have internet everywhere, which has been the hopes and dreams of people out there, right? Where you have this ubiquitous notion that this just anywhere you are, you have full speed on any device at any time. So who's going to be, is it going to be a Cisco? Yeah. Is it going to be, I mean, who's going to
strangely enough, I mean, I don't think we really understand what the impact of 5G is going to be. You know, our networks are already very fast. And even our networks, when you're just walking around with your smartphone on your smartphone in your pocket, the speed is extremely fast. So if you went from like being able to access a page on the internet while you're walking around on your smartphone from, let's say, you know, 20 milliseconds and then with 5G, it's 5 milliseconds. Are you really going to notice the difference?
No.
And if you want to download something for Netflix, from Netflix to your iPad, you know, mm-hmm. take a trip. Mm-hmm. Ever done that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, one of the selling points of 5G is that it's going to make downloading, you know, almost instantaneous. Well, hello, it's already almost instantaneous. You know, it takes about 10 seconds to download.
So do you think this is more of a Netflix? Do you think this is more of a, as you said, talking point, and without any evidence of spying and any evidence of them in any kind of nefarious kind of act of gathering data? And is it more so of a positioning of defense to bring our companies to the fore so they can then produce whatever that particular product is going to be?
Honestly, I think it's a negotiating point more than anything else. You know, if there was a real concern that Huawei was stealing ideas and secrets from the companies that it was installing network equipment in, I think we'd already see criminal cases.
And I think the companies, or at least the companies wouldn't be using their products.
Exactly.
So
ipso facto. I mean, yeah. So I just think it's more of a talking point for the so-called trade war than anything else. By the way, the point I was trying to make with 5G is that we don't really know what the impact is going to be. I mean, I don't think speed necessarily is the issue, maybe more latency, the quickness of latency. But, you know, people use in the early days of YouTube, that seemed, you know, it was really, YouTube was fairly slow, but people managed to use it widely on their 2G and 3G telephones.
Yeah, right? you're just more patient.
Yeah. So, you know, we don't really know what kind of business models are going to be built on 5G. I think we can speculate. I think it's going to be awesome, but I can't really say from this point what those new systems, products, consumer devices are going to look like.
Well, it's possible, which is my next topic. It has something to do with maybe some of the autonomous driving and the ability to update and upload and download as you're out in the street so that you have a much better model for the instantaneous adjustments to your driving situation.
I absolutely agree. I think that autonomous driving or connected driving is going to be a huge impact. This will be a major way that 5G impacts people's lives.
So let's talk about the autonomous
car. So that every car on the freeway is connected to every other car, and or vehicle or truck, and we'll keep its space. You may have the benefits of autonomous driving, which is lower, improved safety without actually going to autonomous driving, which would be kind of cool.
That would be, yeah, right. It's a whole different direction, actually.
But don't forget, but we're talking about a long-term impact, because we're talking about, you know, hundreds of millions of cars on the road today would have to be outfitted or retrofitted with the new equipment.
Well, that's the problem.
It'll take years and years.
That's the problem with autonomous driving in terms of safety. It's not that the cars maybe are not safe. It's the other people on the road. It's all the other cars.
Yeah, it's
the other people.
It's the other people, isn't it?
Right. Always.
Yeah, you know that. You live in Florida. It's always that.
Always.
That person whose head barely is above the steering wheel.
Yep. Cotton heads driving with their hands above there and just driving around, especially during in certain areas like Hallandale. Well, it used to be Hallandale. Now it's kind of like, you know, some other areas. But let's talk about autonomous driving for a second, because there's been a lot of discussion about, oh, it's right around the corner. You know, Tesla's out there with their thing, and you got just a number of companies with their hands in some kind of, you know, car-related driving situation. So when is this really going to become a reality? Because I think, as you mentioned just a second ago, the problem you have is not only just the idea of perfecting, because it has to be perfecting autonomous driving. And then the second thing is then what do you do with all the cars that are not equipped? Right. So what's the turnaround on this whole thing?
Well, I think we're looking at a pretty long ramp, but you know, it's already here. In Finland and Sweden, they're already using autonomous buses for, you know, limited routes. Waymo is already using autonomous driving in certain areas of the Phoenix, Arizona area. The science behind autonomous driving is largely solved. Mostly the concern now is political. And my view is that autonomous driving will really take a level, will really move to the next level once the insurance companies get on board and give people significant discounts for using an autonomous car versus autonomously driven car versus their own driving. And in fact, I think that, you know, if you look at 15 years from now, people will still have, you know, let's say that autonomous driving is the norm. People will still be able to drive their own cars if they want, but they'll just have to pay maybe 3 or 4 times the insurance rates of a non-autonomous car.
And people like that. Listen, a lot of people still have manual shift transmissions that were...
Well, there are people who still transport themselves by horse.
That's true. That's true.
I've heard, I don't know if this is true or not, but I've heard that some people walk.
No.
Still.
No.
I've heard it happen.
So let's kind of dig deep into this autonomous driving issue, because I want to talk about how you envision it benefiting the world. What I mean by that is, already you mentioned the whole idea that, well, insurance costs will be potentially lower. That would be good. So that's great. And of course, you may have fewer accidents. Now, when you kind of look at this, and just on those two items right there, the two items are fewer accidents, lower cost of insurance. Then you got to look a little bit further. Yeah. Okay, what does that do to personal injury attorneys? Right? That kind of messes their whole model up, because 90% of their business is from car accidents.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's true. I mean, there were a whole lot of people who were responsible for getting oats to horses in 1910 who looked at the Model T and said, oh my God, that guy's going to put me out of business.
Yeah.
And it did.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, business transforms. There's no stopping it.
But who's leading?
One of the impacts that you didn't mention is that people who commute theoretically will get an hour or more back in their lives. So instead of, it'll be more like taking the bus to work if you have an autonomous car, then it would be driving. So you can consume entertainment. You can serve drinks. You can read, et cetera, rather than. I think this whole idea of getting maybe an hour back in the lives of commuters is a really big deal. I mean, think about that.
Yeah,
it's hour
gigantic.
Or more.
Right, it's gigantic. And then you have the other thing that's really interesting is
I just want to say, jump in here in case I forget. This is why, one of the reasons I think one of the business models of the future is commuter cocktails.
Ah, I like it.
Go ahead.
I like it.
I mean, if you can just jump in your car and have a gin and tonic rather than have a car and just gripping the steering wheel for an hour, until you get back to your suburb. I mean, it's a big difference.
There's a lot of good things you do in the car if it's somebody else's driving. I mean, you know. Now, here's a question. So I've been thinking about this autonomous driving, the concept of this, and you think about it where you may not actually have to own a car, or you have a choice to own a car, or you may own a fleet of cars. In other words, a car sits in your driveway or in your office 90% of the day. You're not driving 10% of the day. So even maybe 95% of the day, it's unused.
It's a wasting asset.
Wasting asset. Yeah. So instead of that, let's just say you, myself, another 20 people, we buy, you know, 5 cars. And that car is available to, you know, I push a button on my phone. I say, hey, come get me. And the car gets me, and then it goes to the next place. It rests somewhere. And then I can say, you know what? Nobody's using the car on this Saturday. Nobody needs the car. Take it and send it out, and then we'll lease it out to an Uber or Lyft or whoever else is out there for ride sharing and make some money back on it. This is
I agree. There's going to be lots of different business models. The ones that you described is very plausible. I don't really know at this point. I don't think anybody really knows what the main use of autonomous vehicles is going to be. Is going to be like neighborhood owned fleets. Is the city, are your cities going to own the fleets and send them out to you? Are you going to walk to, are they going to be more like buses where you just, you know, get on a bus with 3 or 4 other people? Nobody really knows what the business model is going to be. We just know that it's going to change. And, you know, the people who are the most excited about this, not to mention also nervous and going crazy, are the urban planners, because, you know, they're the ones who have to plan for what these cities are going to be like, you know, 20 years from now. And they're not really sure.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because I was with a group of builders who build apartment complexes. And we were talking about that right now, a normal apartment complex has, let's say you have a, I don't know, 25-story, 30-story building. The first 7 stories are parking garages.
Correct. So this is a big deal.
Right. So the question then came up, okay, well, what do we do here? Because the parking garage is built with a certain spec to, you know, there has to be a lot of open areas, and they use this rebar. You can't just cut open and change it. So the question is, how do you now plan a garage that can be converted into back to apartments or some other kind of facility? And at the same time, until you need that, it serves as a garage.
This is a really important question that apartment building and skyscraper building companies are really worried about. You know, right now we know exactly how much space they need for parking, but 5 to 10 years from now it might be half or less, and they've got to adjust. So it's definitely a concern, and I don't think anybody has the answer yet.
Yeah,
to tell you the truth.
Let's.
What did the people say? What did the builders say that you were working with?
They said they're going to have to change the specs of the garage and do a different walling style in order to make sure that the floors above it can be either cut or added onto, so that you know, they'd have to probably start with the top floors first, obviously, but they would have to change. There's a certain structural. A certain way they create the structure in a garage that if you know, it's almost like a retaining wall or a structural wall. And if you take that down, the whole apartment building falls down. So they have to kind of change the process of that and also start looking at, as they're planning the garage, how can they then plan at the same time, make it a retrofit design if they ever so need it. And that will obviously have to pass city planning right now. So that's kind of a weird.
I see a lot of business for consultants.
Yeah. Yeah, that's another thing. You talked about this whole consultant area earlier when we talked. Something that probably is an overlooked or maybe even not as a sexy style sector of investing. And you mentioned that the consultants are something that you really think is an area that should be looked at closely in the markets. And probably I would venture to say most people that are listening to us right now have no idea any of the companies that are involved in the sector.
Well, I'll give you an example from a different sector. Let's just say airlines. Let's say that you're Alaska Airlines and you've decided that they can have a competitive edge against your competitors. You'd like customers to be able to track their luggage from the time that they drop it off in the terminal to the time they pick it up at their destination.
Right.
And so you have this vision, like, you know, we can put tags with super cheap sensors, maybe the sensors that cost like a tenth of a penny. And so we have this idea and you have this dream, but you don't have an IT department that's even remotely capable of executing on that idea. So you go to a consulting company, and these consulting companies are extremely flexible in terms of the number of people that they employ and the number of businesses that they can get into. So what Alaska Airlines would do go to a company, and I'm not saying that Alaska has gone to this company, but they would call up a company like Accenture, and they would say, all right, come in and look at this new software idea we have. Who do we go to make it happen? So what they would do is they would look at the business case, and they would match it up with computer scientists or developers who could actually execute on that plan. And they would Accenture would either have the software expertise on hand to do it themselves, or they would farm it out to another organization. But these consulting companies are going to be more and more important as the digital transformation of business rolls forward. And I've basically spotlighted five of these consulting companies that are unique and have a special expertise in this area. The first one is Accenture. It's symbol ACN. That's a $119 billion company. They're based in Ireland, and they are the biggest and the best in this space. Another company that I like a lot is called CDW, and a lot of people know them from their mail order pieces that they get in the mail, but mm-hmm. CDW has expanded from being just a mail order computer company to being the top small and medium-sized consultant, some small and medium-sized companies that want to move their business into the cloud. And CDW is a $15 billion company. The third one I like is Booz Allen Hamilton, BAH, and that's a $8.5 billion company, so quite a bit smaller. They specialize in the digital transformation of government. So if the IRS wants to create a new piece of software that helps people find their taxes, et cetera, they'll turn to a consultant like Booz Allen. And companies like Booz Allen will literally have, you know, like hundreds, maybe even thousands of employees directly in the government structure to help them on with the digital transformation. So Booz has done terrific. Another company I like in this space is Gartner Group. Their symbol is IT. They're a $13 billion company, and they specialize in the digital transformation of medium-sized companies as well as large companies. They also throw big conferences where people exchange ideas on these subjects. And they're also a company that you would go to for a white paper on a particular subject relating to, let's say, digital transformation of your business. Mm. So Gartner Group is symbol of IT, and that's a tremendously well-run company. And then finally, I've got a little one, a $3.3 billion consultant called Globant, G-L-O-B-A-N-T. It's a great symbol. Their symbol is glob. And they were originally based in Argentina. But now they're global. They have offices in San Francisco as well as, you know, look, I think the European center is in Liechtenstein. And they're a little bit different than the other consultants. They will help you brainstorm and come up with ideas for the digital transformation of your business. But they also have a big team of software developers themselves, and they actually develop the products in-house. They don't farm it out to other companies.
Interesting.
It's a relatively small company at $3.3 billion market cap. I think they can get to be at least a $10 billion company over the next 4 or 5 years.
Wow, pretty impressive.
The reason I like these companies, once again, just to reiterate, Andrew, is you're not making a bet on the software itself. You're making a big bet on the digital transformation of business. When I say digital transformation, I think, you know what I mean by that?
I mean, I think, well, you explain it, but I understand.
Well, I mean, let's just say for a great example would be how Netflix transformed from being a company that sent DVDs on disc through the mail to a company that is the leading streamer of entertainment over the internet. You know, that's, you know, TV, you know, shows on DVD was a physical product you held in your hand. But now the product of Netflix is just digits. It's just digits that just a digital stream that you download over the internet.
Right.
So that transformation from hard things to soft things, from hardware to software, that's the biggest transformation in business in our lifetimes. And these companies are the ones that are coming up with the ideas and helping the companies execute on them. So instead of betting on the actual products themselves, you're betting on the fact that that companies are going to need to make this transformation. And there's a limited number of companies that they go to for that business.
You know, that kind of leads me into another area. I call them sticky companies. This is technology companies that you have to have. Now, of course, you know, you look at a Netflix. Do you have to have Netflix? Well, I mean, you know, some people have to have their Netflix. But, you know, if you have to cut things back eventually, okay. But they're a sticky company because, you know what, where else are you going to go? And it's, if you leave them, it's like, oh, you know, it's only $14 a month or whatever it is. Microsoft, Adobe, DocuSign. These are what I would consider some, just a couple of the names, in the area of sticky business. Whereas, for example, you look at a company like Adobe. What are the other, where else are you going to go? You can find some free PDF programs for business, and maybe you can find some kind of alternative to photo or video editing. But then there's a whole suite of things that they have. All these people are trained on it right now. Your employees are using them. They're so integrated in the business. And they're charging a monthly seat charge, you know, for example.
Yeah, and they moved to a subscription model. It's been fantastic for them.
Right. DocuSign. If you've ever used DocuSign as a business, I was just talking about this with Frank Curzio this week. You know, it streamlines, it helps, it makes it so efficient. And once you get all your templates on there and everything ready to go, the idea of switching to somewhere else is horrifying. Same thing with like a Salesforce. Well,
and DocuSign is a great example of it. That DocuSign is a great example of a company that is at the center of digital transformation, where, you know, people used to send documents back and forth with couriers, right? You know, you have a physical piece of paper, and now business has decided that they accept electronic signatures. And so a DocuSign is born, and DocuSign has really managed to dominate their space. They're not the only company, and there are lots of cheaper companies, but they're the ones that have space in consumers' minds, and I like them a lot, too.
And you know, it's interesting. These are what, I call them sticky companies. You have a company like a Salesforce. You know, I have Salesforce. The thought of actually going somewhere else to a different CRM of any sort for a small company or especially a large company, the cost factors to do so, the headache that's involved, the remapping, the redoing, because all the time that you took to put into customizing this system for yourself, which is, you know, it's a standard system that you can customize. So my thought is that, you know, you want to look for these sticky companies. You know, you want these one-hit wonders like a GoPro, where that kind of thing can be outdone by another company, done a little bit cheaper. And who cares if you get another camera, right? You know, buy a camera and then switch. Who cares?
What you're saying also is that hardware is a much harder sell.
It's a much harder sell. Much harder sell. But software also, there are certain companies that have this sticky factor to them that you know, if you look out there and you look to some of these companies, and in addition to that, they're at a they've changed their model. I remember when I had Adobe's full suite, it was like, I don't know, $1,500 back in the day. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I want that. I'll just take this and I'll take that and that'll be fine. It'll cost me $200. I'm done. And you never updated it. You never updated. If you ever want it, you're like, I'm not updating because if I update, it's going to cost me another round of money. I'm not doing it. So you have like three versions prior. Now what the companies have done, they say, you know what, for $40 a month or $30 a month or whatever it is a month, you just pay us and we'll keep you updated. It's in the cloud. Right. You don't lose anything. It's easy to deal with. Nothing's going to be missed here. And it's only a few dollars a month. They made it almost like a car sales. Oh, it's a $35,000 car. That hurts. But you know what? You only get paid $250 a month. Mm-hmm. So anyway, just a little thought on that. If you had anything else to say about that.
I think that I agree with that. But it's pretty hard, I would say, for a lot of the bigger companies to become as sticky as they'd like to be. I look at Apple, for instance. You know, Apple's main driver of sales is their iPhone. But, you know, the iPhone is in the iPad, but the iPhone is really just a hard piece of hardware that's very popular right now. But I think, you know, our use of them is going to change. There's a lot more competitors driving down the price of these phones. And so Apple is trying to move away from hardware and into the services space. But you know, it's really hard to replace the margins of an iPhone with services,
right?
Especially when those services are available from so many other places. So, you know, what I want to say is that 5 years ago, you might have put Apple on your super sticky list, and now I don't think you would.
Right. I would agree with that. I mean, the only thing is that there is something to be said about, for example, iMessage, where you can just use that. But that's why Facebook is going after the ubiquitous messaging system. They want to be the central part of that, and realizing that if they do that, then they can. I mean, a big part of Apple is that, you know, you have the iMessage, and even though you can use text messaging otherwise, but there's also the infrastructure and the backbone of the storage and all this stuff. Now, you could do that with a lot of other phones as well, of course. But there are a couple of things involved with the iPhone that's like, I'm not changing. I don't want to change. Even though, to be honest with you, it doesn't talk to a lot of my other machines like I'd want it to. You know, mm-hmm. I just got an Android TV. I got to kind of do some workarounds for that. And I got to use the Apple TV. And it'd be much easier if I wanted to stream directly with my phone to my TV, that would work. And maybe the cars are going to be the same thing. So Apple's, as you point out, it's not only they're not super sticky anymore, but they need to be careful that they don't wall themselves off.
Yep.
So.
And I think that their new news service, they tried to really ram it down publishers' throats, and publishers said, take a hike.
I don't know. The last two announcements by Apple, I thought were anticlimactic. There was no climax at all. I mean, it was just like you're doing a new service and you're calling it whatever, News Plus, and you're doing this and you're calling it a plus.
Always feel like whenever you see the word plus on a product, you just avoid that company completely.
Yeah, it's like they didn't do anything but just add a price tag to it.
All right, and they say, but it's plus.
Yeah, exactly. That's all the time we have for this, John. I want you to tell everybody how to get a copy or a sample or a version or something of the various things you have. I want to give you a couple of seconds, a minute, to talk about the selection, the buffet of products that you have available.
Sure. Well, my flagship service is called Strategic Advantage, and it comes out five times a week in the evenings. And I think people would love to start with that. That's just go to markmancapital.net/publications. markmancapital.net/publications, and you can see how to subscribe to get a 2-week trial of Strategic Advantage. And in addition, if people like options, I have two services. One's called Tactical Options, just focuses on equity options, and I have another service called Counterpoint Options, which focuses on ETF options. And finally, for the people who are into futures, I have a service called Invariant Futures, which helps people buy the S&P 500 E-minis, the Russell 2000 E-minis, the NASDAQ 100 E-minis, and the Dow E-minis. That's called Invariant, and people can see it at the markmancapital.net/publications, or they can just call me at 206-651-4566.
Well, that's great.
That number again, 206-651-4566.
Ah, you're getting good at this. That's good. You're sounding good. Well, John Markman, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Exactly.
All right, hey, have a good weekend. Love to the family for me, okay?
Likewise. Thank you. Take care.
And that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. A lot of things I talked to you about today, some great information where you can get some free newsletters from John Markman and check out what he's talking about. Very, really, really good stuff. And of course, on Fridays, the Trigger Charts webinar on pre-market rundown, which you can register over on the Disciplined Investor. There's a little button on this episode, a little link, or over on triggercharts.com. Until next week, make sure to have some fun this weekend. Go out and imbibe, take a walk, go to the beach, go boating, spend some time with family, do barbecue, eat, have a great time. And until next week, I bid you adieu. See you then. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.